Across the UK, across continental North America, and around the world on the internet by webcast and podcast, my name is Howard Hughes, and this is The Unexplained. There is only one. And this is edition 26, as promised, the second show from the Beyond Knowledge Conference last weekend, as I speak these words, in Liverpool, England. An amazing event. Very, very well attended, and well done Dave Truman and Larry Warren and everybody who was involved in this. I was delighted to be part of it, getting Richard C. Hoagland to come across and give his amazing findings, which you will hear, if you haven't heard them yet, on the front page of this website at the moment, and also for all time in edition 25. But this is edition 26. Last time round, we spoke at the conference to Mr. Hoagland, Steve Bassett, and Nick Pope. This time round, we have Ralph Ellis and Peter Robbins. Just to say very quickly, thank you for all the emails. Keep them coming. Please go to the website, www.theunexplained.tv. And thank you again to Adam Cornwell, the man who gets this show out there and also designs this website. And I know you like Adam's designs because you've been telling me. Okay, let's start this one with Ralph Ellis, a man who's done a lot of research about the pyramids and about various structures like them around the world and how they may all be linked. This is Ralph Ellis.
I'm talking about the pyramids and possible alien intervention in their construction and design. So, yeah, it's an old topic, but it's a new slant on an old topic.
It fascinates people, though, doesn't it? We've seen a lot of documentaries on television. You've only got to watch the Discovery Channel for a week. There's bound to be one on there. And the claim is that the pyramids, but not only the pyramids, were built in a particular way so that they line up with planetary aspects. Yes. But not only that, of course, how were those people back then able to build things with such precision? So there are so many questions around the pyramids, and they remain unexplained and they remain unanswered. So what will you be saying about them?
Well, the first thing is obviously the construction and the size of the stonework they were using. I've just come back from Baalbek in Lebanon. A site that's not been very open to us for the last 10 years. And, of course, they've got the Temple of Baalbek there, which has some of the largest stones ever used. I'll be showing some photos of those. These stones they were using to construct the temple were about 1,000 tons each, roughly. The largest one, I think, was 1,200 tons. So we're talking about stones the size of an average house sort of thing being used to construct a temple. And you have to ask yourself, how is that possible?
Well, you could say the same thing about Stonehenge, couldn't you?
Oh, but these are much, much bigger than Stonehenge. I mean, Stonehenge, we're talking 80 tons. Here, we're talking 1,200 tons.
So that's the size of a ship, isn't
yes,
it, really?
It is, a small fishing vessel.
Possible for a civilization with the kind of abilities and technologies that they had available, as far as we surmise, to do that?
Yes, well, and why? You know, even if you could, at a pinch, do it. Why? It's difficult.
Why was it important to them to do that feat?
If it was simple. You would not do something that was beyond your capability, so it must have been simple for them. And you have to ask the question, how was it simple to use blocks of stone that weighed 1,000 tons apiece? We would not do it today. Why did they do it then? I think because they had the capability then, because they borrowed the capability from somebody else. They were given assistance, as it were.
But what evidence for that is there?
Well, then I go into the mathematics and what the design of these megalithic monuments actually mean.
That sounds very, very spooky. It's just somebody. This is a really busy conference area, so we've got people walking in and out. That was an appropriate sound effect there, Ralph.
It was indeed.
So you say.
Yes. The design of these monuments obviously means something. So what were they trying to do? And I had a look at these monuments, and it seemed to me that they were actually trying to design maps. Might sound strange, but I think they are actually maps of the Earth. And this started with a look at Avebury, and you can probably imagine Avebury if you can imagine what it looks like from above, sort of a circular monument with an axis and an equator, and it's sort of tilted 23 degrees towards the left. In other words, what we're looking at, if you look at it from above, is an image of the Earth. And then I go into why we can prove that it's an image of the Earth, because it has lines of latitude and longitude on it and so on, which actually confirm this. So I thought this was interesting, but of course, by no means conclusive. So then I started looking at the pyramids, and lo and behold, I found exactly the same design within the Great Pyramid. It's a map of the world.
So civilizations who could not possibly have known each other had a common thread.
Absolutely. And also, how did they have a knowledge of what the Earth looked like? I mean, we're talking here with Avebury, we're talking Neolithic man. How would they know what the Earth looked like, that it had an axis, an equator, that the lines of latitude and longitude were as they drew them on the map? How did they manage to have this sort of knowledge?
Let's say it again. When was this?
Well, we don't know. Even if you take classical chronology, they're talking about Neolithic era. We're talking 2000, 2500 BC. I think we're looking a bit beyond that, and we're probably looking to about 10,000 odd BC for various reasons, mainly linked up to the precession of the equinox and looking at the sign of Leo. But then I went along, of course, to Giza, and I found the same effect there, the same design, that we're looking at a map of the Earth. And this one's more difficult to visualize. This is why you need to come to a conference, really, to actually do this. But this is in my book, Thoth, Architect of the Universe, where obviously I have all the diagrams there. But if you imagine the chambers inside the Great Pyramid and just turn them upside down, you end up with a map of the world, complete with the continents of Africa, Arabia, and Asia. And it's quite a convincing-looking diagrammatic, schematic map of the world.
If that is so, that is absolutely staggering. And that sounds to me as if that there is some knowledge of the world that they, for reasons of their own, that we can't know, or we might be able to find one day, they wanted to preserve that information.
Yes, well, I think even more than that, because we end up with maps, maps complete with latitudes and longitudes on them. And why do we need a map? What do we do with maps? What do we use them for? Well, we use them to mark points on the Earth. Yeah, that's why we have maps. So what I think they were doing is specifically locating a particular point on the surface of the Earth. And the reason? Well, I think we come back to the idea of the Hall of Records. We've always had this ancient mythology of a Hall of Records being left somewhere. And if that is so, you need a map. Otherwise, you cannot find it. So this is what I think we're probably looking at here.
So these people were traveling because you need a map to travel. Do we think that?
Not entirely. What I think is happening here is I think we have a 2001 Space Odyssey situation. You remember the great film and book by Arthur C. Clarke. And he postulated that early man had assistance from an alien civilization. They left a megalith on the Earth, which pointed a direction towards looking for another megalith on the moon. And when you discover this megalith on the moon, it called home and said, hey, you know, man has arrived in the technological world. That was the whole basis of the Arthur C. Clarke story. And I think we have the whole same story delivered to us within the megalithic monuments. So we have the megalithic monuments as the markers on the Earth that have been left, a sort of Kilroy was here sort of marker. You know, we were here. Have a look at these monuments because they're very technical, they're very mathematical, and they have some very interesting information. You look at them and you find their maps, and the maps will point you to a particular location because you need to find the Hall of Records, or whatever it is they want you to find. And whatever it is they want you to find is not going to be, because, you know, we've had all these people groping around the Giza Plateau looking for buried treasure and all the rest of it. But it's never going to be that simple, is it? You know, if you're going to set a quest, a task for someone, you're not going to bury it under the pyramids, which is so obvious. You know, someone's going to be there. As I wrote in my book, you don't want someone discovering the secrets of the universe by digging a latrine. It wants to be a slightly more lateral thinking than that. So I think we have this idea of maps which will then point you into the right direction to go and find whatever it is they want you to go and find.
So if there was a guiding hand behind all of this, how come we have now got to a stage where as a civilization we are today in 2009, we lost a lot of this information. It seems that the human race lost its way.
Yes, I suppose it did. I mean, they were given guidance. Again, we come back to 2001. They were given guidance. They were given an initial leg up on the road to civilization. But there was obviously a bit of a non-interference policy here.
So the idea being it's almost
you
like Star Trek.
Yourself.
Yeah, it's the non-interference
Absolutely.
Directive, the prime directive.
The prime directive, non-interference.
We'll start you off, yep. We'll give you some information, you're going to grow up somewhat, it's like having a child.
You've got to do it yourself.
Then you've got to take it from there. So here we are today, and maybe that power, extrapolating from all of this, if we can, knows where we are today, knows that we're rediscovering this stuff and might want to take us to another stage?
Possibly, but I think we've got to get there ourselves, because there would be no point in making all of this megalithic architecture, which is designed to last thousands of years, if they were looking over our shoulder every 2 minutes. So the mere fact that they've made this indelible in stone that's designed to last thousands of years means to me that they're not coming back every 2 minutes to have a look. They're going to come back every 26,000 years to have a look.
You mentioned Thoth, architect of the universe. Now, yeah. I know people in South Africa who are channelers. I don't know what you think of channeling, but they claim to channel Thoth, a supreme being, an ascended master, a great power. Does any of that they are doing, and those people are listening to you now, because I have a lot of listeners in South Africa, mm-hmm. does any of that chime with you? Does it tie in with what you're doing?
It sort of ties in, but I try to stay away. I stay in the rational world rather than the ethereal world. So I'm doing this from a particularly scientific point of view. I'm still coming out with the same ideas as people who will go through channeling routes and so on. So I don't indulge very much in that. But what I've discovered, although being purely rational, purely logical, purely scientific, is still nevertheless very thought-provoking, earth-shattering, because it goes further than this, because I actually discovered the point that they were pointing at, the location they were pointing at with these maps, of course. And that was quite a revelation to me. I did have to sit down, rather, after I discovered it. Because you end up with a set of coordinates. The coordinates are provided by the air shafts in the Great Pyramid. And those coordinates give you a triangle up in the Himalayas. And it just so happens that the triangle in the Himalayas is exactly the same ratio size as the Great Pyramid itself. So it's identical.
That's astonishing, isn't it?
The Great Pyramid, yes, gives you a map that shows you a triangle that is a copy of the Great Pyramid itself. So the one is mimicking the other. And then I thought, because this is a huge triangle, it's 800 kilometers high, you know, across. So I then thought, you know, well, where within this triangle are we supposed to look? You know, it's huge. And the obvious place would be in the center. So I did that. So I went to look at the center, and the very center of this triangle is K2, the second highest mountain in
wow.
the world. So then I had to scrabble around and look for a map of K2. Do you think I could find it? It took me about 6 months, I think, to find it. This is prior to the age of Google Earth. You know, Google Earth didn't exist in this era. So, you know, every map I found had K2 as about 5 millimeters across, which is not what I was looking for. Finally, I found a map in China. I had to go to the Chinese Cartographical Institute. And they said, oh, yes, we've got a map of China. And they sent me a copy in the post. And I opened this up, and that's when I sat down. Because what I found is that K2 is a pyramid. And it's a pyramid that is exactly the same as the Great Pyramid. So it's white, just as the pyramid is white, and that's why all the pyramids are those colors. If you look at the plateau, you have the Great Pyramid is all white, the second pyramid is white with a little line of red around the bottom, a line of granite at the bottom, so it has a snow line. And if you go further down the range, the third pyramid only has a white peak, so it only has snow on its peak, because it's further down the range, which is exactly what you see in the Karakoram range.
All right, so why, this is a big question, why is the focus of all of this K2? What power has K2 got?
Well, we were looking for a specific location on the surface of the Earth that was somewhat special, where we might find something special. So I started at the Great Pyramid. The Great Pyramid had coordinates, which sent me off towards the Himalaya, towards Karakoram, and I find another pyramid that's identical to the one I first started at. It even has, it's square, it's aligned with the cardinal points, exactly the same as the Great Pyramid, and it has a causeway coming out at exactly the same angle.
But it hasn't been built by somebody. That's the difference, yeah?
No. This is where it gets very esoteric. So we found this special location. So if you're looking for a special location, there must be something special there. So if we're looking for a Hall of Records, well, it's there, isn't it? And it'll be in the same location within K2 as it is within the Great Pyramid, because they're copies of each other. They're identical monuments.
Well, up to this point, you've had all your ducks in a row, and every hypothesis that you had has worked out for you. So this is the final frontier, isn't it?
It is, and I did go up there, but I was not able to get to the location I want to get to because there was huge great fissures up there. So it needs a rather large expedition.
But Ralph Ellis, what you're saying is absolutely staggering, because you've been led through this puzzle and taken to this place, and there is so much evidence that you say stacks up towards it. When you find that location, there must be something, I would have thought, if this all works out as you hope that it will, amazing there.
No, I'm fairly lateral, fairly logical. I think it'll be set fairly simple. Again, think Arthur C. Clarke, think 2001 Space Odyssey. What we will find is a telephone.
You mean a way to communicate with something?
We need to phone home, yes.
And do you want to be the person who makes that contact? Do you want to be Jodie Foster?
that would be interesting. Yeah, that would be a very good idea. Yes, I think basically we would come down to that. We would come back to something simple. The acknowledgement that we've arrived in the technological era, you would find a telephone, a communication device, and you could communicate with whoever set up this. Because going back to, you were saying, K2... Is you know, a natural mountain. No, it's not. Yes, I can see your look of horror.
I've seen the documentaries. It looks natural enough to be.
Except it's a pyramid. How did they find a pyramid? Well, let's come back to the original quest. I started with the Great Pyramid. The coordinates that came from the Great Pyramid are based on pi. So that's a fixed direction and a fixed distance. So the only thing that has any line of latitude on this quest is K2 itself. So the bottom line is K2 has to have been manufactured. Artificial. It's an artificial mountain.
But it's huge.
It's vast.
How can that be? Mind you, if it's possible to move 1,000-ton stones, then it's not a great leap of your head, is it?
To a million ton stones.
To a million tons. This is wonderful, wonderful stuff. But it must frustrate you, because this is, if it is what it appears to be, is at the core of everything that we are and will ever be, that governments are not as interested in this as they might be. Maybe there's a reason behind that, than just money.
We've become very sceptical, I suppose, of the possibilities that are out there. You know, the Victorians weren't. The Victorians were into this in a big way, and we're looking quite openly. Nowadays, it's more covert. You know, people are more furtive about it. It's very fringe, except possibly maybe in some of the American agencies like the NSA, perhaps, are more open to this than others. I don't know.
Well, if you were a conspiracy theorist, you would say that there are governments like the United States, and probably ours, who know all of this already, because they are the people who are deputed by the Illuminati, whoever they might be, to be in the position that they're in. And they know all this stuff already, but they don't want us to know, the ordinary plebs out there on the street.
Possibly, but I think they've forgotten their history. There's been too many Chinese whispers on the road, and I think they've lost it. You know, I'm a Mason. I inhabit Masonic circles, and people within Masonry do not know of this. So unless somebody very high up knows of it, I think the information has basically been lost.
So this is some information that not even the Masons are in on. No. It's bound to be interesting then. So what the ultimate point of your quest is to find the telephone and then decide what to do next, presumably.
Yes, that would be interesting. I mean, it's been a long quest. It's been an interesting quest. It would be interesting to see if my hunch is correct.
So, well, if it is, there's a book in it, there's a movie in it, and there's a lifetime of talking about it for you, I would have thought.
It would be pretty amazing if it was true. I mean, it sounds far-fetched. It's very interesting, but, you know, I just say to listeners that they have to have a look at the information, have a look at the book, see the information in there, see all the connections. I tend to be very logical, very rational, and this is beyond what you might expect by coincidence.
And what happens if you get to the point where the telephone is supposed to be, or whatever, and there is nothing there? What do you do then?
Well, you go back to the drawing board. I don't think I'm that far off track. Even if you miss it by a few meters and actually miss the final quest, I think there is something in this. And you keep on looking. But it's something odd happened many thousands of years ago. There is a quest out there. There are enigmas that need to be solved, and we need to keep looking at it. But I think I've got closer than anybody else.
I have to say, before the last couple of weeks when I read the schedule for the Beyond Knowledge conference that my friend Dave Truman sent to me, I hadn't heard of your work. I am fascinated by what you said, and I'm sure people hearing this will be too. If they want to know about you and the things that you've written and things you've said, how do they do that?
Well, the website is Edfu Books, so it's www.edfu.books. hyphenbooks.com. So Edfu Books, that's my publishing company. I run it myself. There's six books out there, actually. Two on the pyramids and four on the Old Testament and New Testament, because they are linked into this as well, because they were the holders of this knowledge. So it's all part and parcel of one big quest. So the six books, all very interesting, all very thought-provoking, and it's all new information that you will not find anywhere else, whether you agree with it or not. It is all very, very new.
And interesting from what you just said, that what I've suspected for a long time is that a lot of our sacred beliefs, a lot of our religions may be not exactly unified, but have common threads.
Very common threads, because in my second book, this is Tempest and Exodus, I clearly point out that Mount Sinai, the most sacred mountain of Judaism and all of Christianity, is the Great Pyramid.
Wow. This is The Unexplained. I'm Howard Hughes. We were speaking with Ralph Ellis there at the Beyond Knowledge Conference in Liverpool, and I wasn't sure what to expect of Ralph Ellis at all. Never met him, didn't know much about him, and I was fascinated, riveted actually, by what he had to say. Coming now, here's Peter Robbins. Peter Robbins I first spoke with a few nights ago on a radio show out of Liverpool at Radio City 96.7 and City Talk 105.9. Peter was in transit at that time on his way to Liverpool for the Beyond Knowledge Conference. His thing is space, but I think you need to listen to his take on it. So, at the Beyond Knowledge Conference again in Liverpool, England, last weekend, here's Peter Robbins.
I'm an investigative writer specializing in the subject of UFOs and have for many years. Of course, very few, if anybody, studies this in school to train for it. My degree is, of course, in painting and film history. I have a Bachelor of Fine Arts. I taught painting for 15 years at the School of Visual Arts. I've worked as an educator. I've worked in management and off-Broadway New York theater. But this is an obsession, and one that I think I've made some good contributions to, and one that I hope to continue doing just that at venues just like this and in my writing.
By the time this is heard, your presentation will have been given. You will probably be back in the U.S. So tell us what you're going to tell people here today.
Well, I won't be in the U.S. I'll be in country for the next few weeks. I'm speaking rather untraditionally today, not about UFOs per se, but about an aspect of the work of one of the most misunderstood, maligned, distorted, truly great scientific minds of the past few millennium, Austrian physician and psychiatrist named Dr. Wilhelm Reich, who in fact did have extraordinary observations and conclusions about UFOs toward the end of his scientific career, part of which were used to help bring his career down. But I'll be speaking today on other aspects of his work, energetic devices that he discovered that usually are maligned in the press. Most people have heard something about him. Almost nobody's read books by him. He was one of the great social thinkers and scientists of ever. And I've been lucky enough to be involved in his work since really I was a teenager. And in therapy many years ago with his former first assistant. So I've spent time with many of the people who he trained, who he knew, who he worked with. And we'll be giving a presentation today specifically around an aspect of this and then sending out papers to fill in the blanks to other people that are interested in more information.
The great thing about this show is that it attracts an audience that is people who know all about this stuff and love this stuff, as I have all my life. But also, it attracts an audience of people who are just curious and just looking.
Yes.
So, when you say the phrase energetic devices, they're going to say, what does that mean?
Yeah. Reich discovered a certain aspect of how energy functions in the universe, whether it's amoeba or the formation of galaxies, that there is a similar formula, and developed two deceptively simple apparatuses, one called an energy accumulator and the other called a cloudbuster. Many people in Britain, especially if you follow the pop music scene, may actually remember.
Kate Bush, Cloudbuster.
That is right.
Love the song.
A very young Donald Sutherland playing the Wilhelm Reich character. It's highly romanticized. Many people feel it's nonsense. I have seen them in operation. It is extraordinary technology. It could green the deserts around the world. I've just come from a full week at a research laboratory in Oregon that does this work, and I will be discussing it at length today. An energy accumulator can do something as simple as charge up garden seeds and give you hardier plants, or one that's more the size of a phone booth can charge your organism, make you healthier, more energetic, a bit more resistant to disease. It's extraordinary technology. It's absolutely documented. It's been with us for over 50 years. And yet, most people that have heard about it buy the mythology the same way that they buy the mythology about UFOs. It can't be. Therefore, it isn't. Therefore, he was a nutter or a charlatan or a delusional or what have you. So I'm hoping to set the record straight to a degree with my presentation today.
25 years ago, when my sister lived in London and I was still here in Liverpool, we used to go around a lot of alternative venues. We used to go to some shops that sold things like ionizers, and they were seen as really out there and slightly wacko. But, you know, we bought this stuff and we bought into all of that. Seems to me that what you're talking about is perhaps the ionizer for the 21st century.
I hope so. And I have a negative air ionizer in my office, and it keeps it just extraordinarily fresh smelling.
But listen, when you talk about something that can give you the key to recharging yourself,
yes.
Well, look, you know, a lot of us have busy lives. I certainly do. I'm all over the place. And sometimes I feel that I could do with a boost, and I turn to stimulants like the one I've got with me here now, Starbucks caffeine. You know, we like the coffee. We drink a certain amount of it, and Diet Coke and all the other stuff that I am into and do. Are you saying that this is something that could, at the very least, supplement that kind of thing for giving us a boost through life?
Without question. And it would be something that if you were a regular user, you might use no more than 10 or 15 minutes a day or twice a day. That would be it. Again, I had an opportunity a month ago to use one every day for a week. And I had not used one in years, and it was quite a physiological reminder that this is not some psychological aberration, but a very real effect. It is documented scrupulously in scientific records kept back to the 1950s, was the subject of a very important court case in the later 1950s in the United States. Reich's work is electrifyingly important and has implications for so many areas of natural science and sociopolitical thinking. Again, he has been derided, distorted, put down, defamed, and declared insane repeatedly while he was alive and since. If I weren't such an involved student of the subject, I would capitulate and say maybe that's true, but it's not.
This guy sounds to me a lot like, you're going to tell me I'm wrong here, but the first name that comes into my head is Tesla.
They were both legitimate geniuses, and like most people who study alternative information, I'm fascinated by Nikola Tesla. Had we followed a different direction in terms of technological development, we probably would not have meters on our homes selling us electricity.
I'm just trying to go back to about a year ago. I was in South Africa, and we went to a lady who I think is called Pauline, but whatever, it'll come back to me. And she had a machine. I was feeling a little down, and I had just had my eyes lasered, and I was adjusting. I was in the adjustment process, which I've now been through. They're fine. But at that time, I thought, are these eyes ever going to sort themselves out? This lady had a machine. I think it's one of these machines, if they are available. And I sat myself in a seat, and she put a couple of little electrode-type things on me, turned this machine on, and we just went into some quiet time, and we did this for about half an hour, and I came out of this feeling, even though I didn't want to believe it, I came out of it feeling a hell of a lot better. Now, this to me sounds like this device that you're talking about here.
And the electrodes, for me, would not have anything to do with the Reich technology, but it is a reminder that there are a number of areas of legitimate study and research which have yielded alternate methodology in dealing with things that we're most used to dealing with drugs, with surgery, or with some other hard mechanical way of dealing with it. And in fact, there are gentle, more natural, more homeopathic or naturopathic ways to take the sea of energy we're surrounded by and assist us in healing or at producing another positive physiological.
Because increasingly, Peter, it seems that people are coming to the realization, which is fact, we know this, that we are all electromagnetic machines just like any other electromagnetic machine, like the old-fashioned tape recorder that we're doing this interview on now, this chat on now. So if we are electromagnetic machines, we, just as this machine, can be affected by magnetism, energy, and forces of different kinds. And that is something, as we go into this new century, perhaps, as you say, we're going to get more and more aligned to.
You're absolutely right. And let's remember that the Western model for medicine is get sick, and we will give you drugs that will suppress the symptoms or cut something out of you, where the Greek model for health intervention was to keep the organism healthy and strong, so that you're basically heading things off at the pass. Our philosophy has shifted 180 degrees, and not for the better. You know, cancer, we probably spent uncounted tens of billions of dollars trying to find ways to cure it, address it. And where are we now? It is still a plague upon us all. The American Cancer Society, bless their hearts, seems to have made no difference in cancer in America. It's mechanical thinking.
But we have to say, and I have to make the point, very, especially in the UK, we have a law about this kind of thing in the UK, and there are also guidelines for broadcast radio, which this is not. Nobody can and dare and should claim a cure for cancer. So if you feel you have those symptoms, first thing you have to do is go to your medical practitioner, and whatever else you want to do on the side is also a matter for you.
Oh, indeed. I think that's just good, sound thinking. But again, to keep an organism strong and healthy, our physicians don't direct us toward that. They wait for us to get sick and then prescribe drugs that they may even be encouraged to prescribe because...
All right. So we're talking prevention here more than anything else.
Yes. And again, the nature of the energy accumulator would be to keep an energetic system strong and in as good a functioning as it can be. The Cloudbuster would literally... try to break up contractions break up contractions in the atmosphere, allowing...
So this is the same technology, the same kind of energy, but being used in different ways.
And again, whether it's an amoeba splitting or a universe forming, it's a four-beat formula that's exactly the same. You have tension, charge, discharge, and relaxation. We see it all through the natural world, from the smallest to the largest. And when it's blocked, there's neuroses or pathology.
You sound very, very calm for a man who's about to make a big presentation. I know you do this all the time, but are you using this technology yourself to psych yourself up for the place that you have to be in when you go on the stage in front of all those people today? And I have to say, here in Liverpool, there has been a fantastic turnout for this Beyond Knowledge conference, which I hope I've helped to build up with Dave Truman, the man behind it. But are you using this for this?
Absolutely not at all. And I don't. Basically, I do my research. I'm a good writer. If it's the kind of topic I can speak extemporaneously on, I'll have a few 3x5 cards. On a talk like this, I literally have to create a script for myself to accompany the PowerPoint. No, I like working in front of a crowd. I'm confident about my abilities as a public speaker. I enjoy this process.
You have, very quickly, one other thing to do here a little later on the day that we're recording this. I'm excited. I know Linda Moulton Howe from earthfiles.com. She is one of the greatest investigators, and she's very charged up at the moment about some stuff to do with Rendlesham Forest, which is very close to my heart because it happened in the UK, and I've spoken to many people, including Larry Warren, who's also here, that great American Liverpudlian. He's one of ours now. he was there on that on those three nights of Rendlesham Forest. You will be presenting parts of a new Linda Moulton Howe DVD here today at the conference. Tell me quickly about that.
It's actually going to be tomorrow, and as you and many of your listeners know, Larry and I were co-authors on the British bestseller Left at East Gate about the incident, which remains the only book ever written or co-written by an actual participant. I'm delighted to report that my good friend and close colleague Linda has gotten equally involved with a central witness as important in his way as Larry, and now other witnesses, has done several presentations in the States on this. And with her and John Burroughs' permission, we are going to be playing this extraordinary lecture that she gave at a conference earlier this year in the States. And I must say, as a research specialist in this particular incident, as knowledgeable as any American, I was transfixed by it. It includes segments of John allowing her to tape him, being regressively hypnotized by his therapist and being brought back to these seminal events in his life. The impact that they have had on him and other men involved is absolutely shattering, even almost 30 years later.
Well, I heard Linda on American radio quite recently talking about this. I know Linda. Linda gets behind a project, gets behind an idea, but I've never heard Linda so excited.
Yeah. I couldn't be happier in that of all of my colleagues. She is one of the most rock solid and a brilliant presenter, and very much a humanist like I am. We put the people first in these cases. And John has come forward in a very courageous manner. And what we are seeing is the beginning of what looks like a potential reunion for the first time in almost 30 years of many of the key individuals, hopefully next year and hopefully in the UK. And I will remain in touch with you on this, Howard, and keep you posted on it.
I'd be very keen to do that. And just in my head is formulating a plan. Wouldn't it be great to get as many of the people who are involved in this thing, including Larry, who's here, and John and Linda, who's now part of all of this, and yourself, maybe go to somewhere near Rendlesham Forest, near RAF Bentwaters Base, and do this thing.
That is what we are developing, and I will be heading down to Rendlesham for about a week, a bit later this month, to do a little field work and see if we can get some sponsorship down there. The number of individuals involved could be quite extraordinary, and it'd be wonderful to have a public forum, but first and foremost, we're looking for an opportunity to give these people a safe, enclosed place near where this shattering event happened, to deal with themselves on it, and hopefully then some of them have the courage, imagination, and goodwill to move forward into the public realm.
So it'll be cathartic for them too?
I would imagine. It was cathartic for me. But again, I spent a decade of my life, to the exclusion of all else, documenting and backing up allegations about this. And I'm very proud of what we were able to accomplish with our book.
In the 60 seconds or so we've got remaining here, tell me, in the wonderful words that you use, because you used them with me on the radio the other night, what do you believe happened at Rendlesham Forest in 1980? What was that thing?
A series of appearances, interventions by technology of an extremely advanced form, beings of undetermined origin, where they were from. 30 years plus in the field gives me an opportunity to say, I have no real idea. But my better sense is based on men who were involved, who have a very strong impression that these were not aliens or little people from another planet, but actually visitors from our future. Again, I can only go with their best intuition. All bets are still there. Something happened of a shattering nature. It's the most important case we have. It's the one we could bring to the United States Congress for investigation. And the future is uncharted on how this is going to progress, Howard.
keep in touch with me about this. This is The Unexplained. My name is Howard Hughes. If you want to contact this show, you know how to do it. Go to the website, www.theunexplained.tv. Drop me an email here, and I promise you that here on this show, we'll keep you posted about that.
Peter Robbins, ending edition 26 of The Unexplained and finishing our coverage of the Beyond Knowledge Conference in Liverpool 2009. It was held across the weekend of the 12th and 13th of September. I'd been on late night radio in Liverpool that week, so I literally went straight from my show and then started working on the conference to bring you this material, and I believe it was worth it. Please let me know what you think about these shows. Please keep your feedback coming. If you're in the radio business and you want to talk about partnering with this show, please get in touch. But at any rate, please tell your friends about The Unexplained if you like it. Let the feedback roll. Adam Cornwell brought you this show through the website he's designed for me and through his other efforts. Thank you, Adam. Martin made the theme tune. You made the show by being there and listening. My name is Howard Hughes. This has been Edition 26, one of two from the Beyond Knowledge Conference in Liverpool, England. And Edition 27 will come to you very, very soon. My name is Howard Hughes, and this is The Unexplained. Take care.